Yeah, thank you. Thank you for coming. In this talk, I will continue to talk about some result from this Tigris simulations, which stands for three-phase intercept medium in galaxies, resolving evolution with star formation and supernova feedback. I'm quite proud of this acronym. Okay, so so the first part, I'm going to talk about the galactic winds or some signature of these galactic winds from this Tigris simulation. It's mainly driven by supernova explosion. And the second part of this talk is it's not about the synthetic observations from this Tigris simulation. Mainly, first talk about the synthetic observation from our previous simulation, and I want to discuss possible extension or possible application using this synthetic observation with this Tigris simulation. So I bring this picture again. So this is my broad schematic picture of this galaxy evolution that we collect all the gas through this large-scale gravitational interaction between dark matters, and that will form a very hot gas within this dark matter halo, and that hot gas can cool down to form stars within the galaxies, and also which it will form fall to the galaxies as a warm and cold medium, and eventually turn into the molecular medium. Then we'll go to the stars or the supermassive black hole, and then they will return energies to this gaseous medium through the radiation, winds, and also supernovae, and through some, I don't really know, but maybe there's some mechanism to blow these energy things away from this AGN feedback. So the reason why we need this kind of large-scale interaction is because we know that this stellar mass function is much from this stellar mass function, we know that this gas, not all the gas turn into the star. So only one-third of them at most turn into the star at the maximum efficiency. But at low mass halo or low mass galaxies, maybe the supernova feedback blow things out so that quenches the star formation. And maybe in the high mass halos, AGN feedback do this job. So there we need these winds, but also we also saw this kind of winds from many observations. So okay, we need to blow things out from the galaxies. So how to do that? Maybe the supernovae, since the supernovae is the most energetic process, especially for this stellar feedback, we can blow things away out from galaxies when we include this supernova feedback. But from this cosmological simulations, we cannot really resolve the every supernova evolution from their early stage to the later stage of their shell formation and the pressure-driven snowflow and the momentum-continuous snowflow, all these kind of stages. We cannot really resolve this. And how can you do that? There are also some different way of implementing such kind of feedback mechanism. Interestingly, they will produce largely different structure of the galactic or intercluster medium. They may look quite similar for some cases, but they are completely different from some cases. So these details of the subgrid physics do really matter. So even in this kind of case, actually they can control their feedback by tuning their parameter, so-called delta T. Then you can really get this star formation rate quite okay for all the cases, but you will get outflow rate very differently depending on what you used for this subgrid physics. So you can actually make heavily loaded wind here, but sometimes you only can get about 10% of the outflow rate compared to the star formation rate.
Can you remind me what delta T is
in this? This is a so-called stochastic model. They are kind of collecting supernovae that make those some their feedback make the temperature at around their given temperature. So
that's the temperature of some hot bubble that is created by a supernova.
Yeah, they are kind of adding the supernovae before exploding, and then. Once they get this kind of temperature, they now explode all this collected supernovae. So by increasing this number, you will collect more supernovae before explosion. So then you will end up having much hotter, some more energetic superbubble.
So, sorry, go ahead. I was just gonna say this is. I just want to understand this figure because I think your point's well taken. But this is the mass change as a function of time, and so there's you presumably that the star formation rate is being balanced by this outflow rate, which outflow rate is dashed line.
Yeah. Outflow rate is dashed line.
So higher delta T is a higher outflow and should be a low.
But I mean, this star formation rate can really regulate it.
Just the mass loading that's varying, right?
Yeah, the mass loading. So. What you can really get a good star formation rate in any case, but that results in quite different outflows, and also they may not only this kind of rate, but also this temperature structure and all this intercluster medium structure, they may be completely different based on your subgrid physics.
So what's the height of the box that we're looking at?
This one?
It's like a couple of milliparsecs.
I'm not really sure, but maybe they, since this is a kind of global simulation, so they may measure it by based on. Right, so, I mean, this is the, I think, this 10 kiloparsec size.
I see.
Yeah, but I don't know where they measure this value.
So I'm just thinking, I mean, for sure the subgrid physics matters, but like, the environment matters in a big way too, what the density profile of the CGM is and whether it's rotating.
Yeah.
I mean, this stuff goes back to like the 90s, right, where it made huge differences in how pollinated the flows were.
Sure. Yeah. At this point, this is kind of those, some experiment. They only change this with physics. And I think this one is kind of, since this is a 10 to the 9 solar mass halo galaxy, I think, so that they can really resolve this supernova feedback by just using simple thermal dump. So they compare this result as a reference with this kind of thing. But even in this case, they are kind of not exploding individual supernovae. They are exploding multiple supernovae at once. So.
But what is their CGM like in this simulation?
I'm not really sure. So this is, I think they kind of adopt some standard, kind of standard test problem of cooling halo, which may be used kind of standardized in this Agora comparison simulation, I think. I don't really know. Sorry. Okay, so that's maybe a big problem. So what we want to really do is, based on this local simulation that I'm running, trying to understand this stellar feedback, their impact on this warm and warm cold medium, and also the hot gas through this self-consistent cycle of the star formation. But I'm not really working. I didn't really include all other kind of radiation, wind kind of thing. Only considering this supernovae. But the radiation is somehow indirectly included by changing heating rate, as I explained yesterday. So, but mainly, the supernova, the wind kind of properties are depending on the supernova. So, I want to focus these things first. So, I want to before I go into my really complex simulation, I want to explain how do supernova feedback work in somehow simpler idealized case. So somehow all theories mainly developed for the supernovae, the radiative supernovae remnant evolution in the uniform medium and in single in one-dimensional spherical model. So actually there are lots of other physics they try to include even in 70s, like two-phase medium or inhomogeneity of the medium and also thermal conduction. But it's not yet really well understood, because all those models still based on their one-dimensional spherical model by just including some of effect with some prescription. There's not many direct simulation for including all those effects. So at this point, I'm only want to show difference between the single supernovae and the multiple supernovae case, and explosion in the uniform medium and the cloud medium case. I don't really talk about the 1D spherical expansion, but I want to compare some result with 3D-dimensional expansion that I'm learning. So, but I still don't really include all these kind of other effects, but they maybe somehow at some point very interesting to consider. Especially this thermal conduction is one of the issue, but this actually we need to model this thermal conduction using, including the magnetic field effects because of this anisotropy of the thermal conduction. So I defer this kind of study later, but yeah, this is another kind of big, I mean, there are lots of things to still we can do in this.
So in this uniform versus cloudy medium, I mean, the real ISM is turbulent.
Yeah.
So rather than putting in some sort of PDF for a turbulent spectrum, it's just you don't have the resolution to do that?
No. I mean, for the turbulent case, I would say that's kind of naturally in our somehow more realistic simulations. So that turbulence itself is self-regulated in that case. What I'm only want to compare it here because between the uniform and the cloudy medium, the one motivation is because many people actually just thought that when the medium was inhomogeneous, all these kind of hot gas just flow out through those low density channels. But I would want to say that is really true when the background medium is this two-phase interstellar medium, that is, we can really think of this cloudy structure. So, yeah, that was.
So you're doing numerical experiments, right, and just varying one of these things each time.
Yeah.
And in your full simulations, these are cosmological.
No. It's a. Okay. It's a local simulation.
Okay.
But I will show you later. So yeah. This is a single supernova evolution, including the cooling. So some local energetic thermal energy, localized this supernova energy is expanding as a blast wave that form this set of Taylor stage of evolution. And as time goes by, this will cool down at the shock. It's the first time at the shock, then they will form a shell, and then after the shell formation, they still can have a hot interior. They can push the shells by adding more momentum, so that can describe as a pressure-driven snowflow, and then in later time, they just have this momentum-conserving phase. So this can be described like here. So at early time, the profile is really like a set of Taylor solution, and then the density gets higher as they cool, so that we form a shell at this point. And then even in after the shell formation, you can still have this hot interior that can really push, overpressured interior that can push the shells a little bit more than you can get somehow higher momentum end up. So that's a typical evolutionary scenario. And that is also true, especially this kind of explosion in the two-phase medium, where we can we realized this two-phase structure by running thermal instability simulation and take some saturated snapshot and explode supernovae in there. So mainly they are kind of propagating through this warm medium, but their warm medium still shock and get suffering this shell formation. And then during this evolution, they can really boost their initial momentum to the about a final momentum by about factor of 10. It is also true for all these cloudy medium case where we use about 10 different realizations to for this background state. So simple conclusion here I got is this momentum, final momentum per supernovae here. Here is just a single supernovae. It's always around 1 to 3 × 10^5. Weakly, very weakly, depending on the background density. But
so how big a range did you vary that background density?
Oh, it's a 0.1 to 100. So, yeah.
So I'm just thinking, I mean, you know, this could be going off in a molecular cloud, or it could be going off
So wind. Right. So I mean the
range and conditions.
Yeah, if it was really exploded within the molecular cloud that just fully surrounded by was around those supernovae with about 100 particles per cubic centimeter, then actually it really cools very quickly. So it's about 1,000 year. After 1,000 year, it will just form form a shell and then cool down interior. They will just, but their momentum injection is still about this order, but they will not really expand that large, so that it just stay there. I mean, you will not, if you just see from the outside, very large scale, those expansions just stay there. So
There's just more inertia in the dense environment.
Yeah, yeah.
So even in a stellar wind room bubble, you think this would still be good? I guess is this a good number for any environment you could go off?
In
the Milky Way galaxy, or?
Yeah, and also it's one interesting thing is that this is a kind of parameter we also plug into our previous the self-regulation picture as a turbulence driving coefficient, and this number is kind of required number from the observation actually. From the object, by just including the turbulent pressure and the star formation rate, our basic theory, the self-regulation picture give us star formation rate should proportional to the turbulent, turbulent pressure should proportional to the star formation rate. The coefficient will be this momentum, final momentum, divided by the M star parameter, which is the total mass of mu stars per supernovae. It's about 100 solar mass. Then also there is another coefficient, the 1/4 factor, but that give the coefficient between this pressure and the star formation rate substance relation. And from the observation, we can just convert it reversely. Then what we need is really about this amount of the momentum. So that can really provide by some other process, but based on our experiment, supernovae can really provide this amount of the momentum always. So that's kind of some argument that supernovae is a really dominant process that can drive the and regulate the star formation. So yeah, this is kind of huge amount of momentum. So that means in most simulation, when include the supernovae, then you should get this amount of momentum. So
is there an order of magnitude way to understand this number?
Right?
Is there an order of magnitude way to understand this number?
Oh, yeah. So that is, you can just, you have this total energy, and then this shock velocity, and usually because those cooling, very strong cooling occurs at around 10 of a million Kelvin. So then that actually give you a velocity around 200 kilometers per second. So if you just those 10 to the 51 are divided by this 200 kilometers per second, that will be the the momentum you really have at the end of the Sabatello stage.
Why is it 200? Is that...
It's about the temperature of this 10 to the...
You're saying you never... Okay, I see.
So that at that temperature, you're suffering very strong cooling, you will lose the internal pressure.
You're saying you can't... You're shocked.
So then you start to... You will exit from those energy conserving stage. Yeah. So during this energy conserving stage, you will keep adding the momentum, but at the end of the energy conserving stage, you cannot really add the momentum. There will be some slight addition by those pressure-driven snow flow phase, but that's just a brief phase. Okay. So yeah, but there is really a kind of numerical requirement to get this right momentum. So when your resolution is very poor, so that you cannot really resolve this trail formation, then also that means you cannot really resolve this set of Taylor stage, then your momentum should always stay at the level of this kind of ejecta level, so that your final momentum is always stays here. To get this right momentum, you should have this kind of resolution. You should satisfy this kind of resolution requirement. That is actually about, you should have about less than 10 parsec resolution for the case when the density is around 1, or if it actually need much higher resolution when you need to do these kind of things at high density.
What is RSF?
That is a shell formation radius, the radius at the shell formation. That is, can actually, we can just analytically calculate this. Okay, so similar thing, I also did some similar experiment with this kind of toy model with this pulse by keep adding this supernovae with this time interval, 0.1 million years here. And then since we keep adding this energy, this it will keep expanding. That means we can keep adding the momentum, and so we can replenish this internal hot gas. But actually, the cooling is very efficient, especially at after this shell formation. After the shell formation, the addition of the hot gas by each supernova is much small. So I will come back to this later, but I first go to the result for this momentum injection. So this is some different model with a different density, different density, and a different time interval. So each starts actually the kind of final momentum of each supernova event. So there is some variety, and also it somehow there is some reduction when you add very frequent supernova very frequently, but it still stays on range of this level, not the order of 10 to the 4. So we can still we usually get this level of the momentum injection per supernovae from this supernovae explosion.
So I don't quite understand what you're learning from this multiple supernova. Mm-hmm. I mean, you calculate the momentum from injection. It's momentum, so it should just add like a vector. So what am I learning by doing this calculation that I didn't know from just doing one?
This kind of explosion will just first will heat up the surrounding medium and then add the hot gas. And as they just keep expanding, there are a lot more gas that can be accelerated by this kind of event. And then the momentum will keep increasing. But for this case, as function of time, we also increasing number of the supernovae, right? And then what this shows is just a division of these two. So I divide the total momentum to the number of supernovae that has been exploded at that time.
But all your supernovae would go off in the center and they're periodic. So is that really the right?
No, no, no.
Meant to be canceling? Is...
Oh, that's not. So I mean, that will be the that should be. I mean, this is kind of some toy experiment. We can just get an idea of this multiple supernova effect. So the real situation is much, completely different, and all those kind of canceling effects will go into play. But I mean, they are mainly driving the turbulence. So by colliding those kind of medium, then they can still. I mean, we can still say each of the events will inject certain level of the momentum.
I mean, in principle, could the energy conserving phase last longer because the supernova explodes?
So this transformation time, actually now I kind of can reformulate the transformation time. It is originally depending on the somehow single energy energy of the single supernova and the ambient medium density, but now I can actually write this with this delta T in this kind of just formulation. Then you can see this transformation time is decreasing when you increasing this delta T, which means your interval is longer than the transformation time is shorter. And if you just explode it very frequently, you can expect longer, larger transformation time, which means longer energy conserving stage, right? Okay. So, and then I want to add one more thing about this hot gas mass, which is quite interesting. So, this is a hot gas mass per supernova. And as I explained also, this hot gas mass can also keep increasing since we keep adding this energy. But also, this is a kind of dividing the total hot gas mass with the number of supernovae at that time. So, what this shows is this hot gas mass per supernova as a function of time, but normalized with this transformation time that I showed before. And all line up well with this transformation ready, transformation time. Up to this time, they keep increasing, but it dropped very rapidly because they now start cool, and then they stays somehow at around 10 solar mass to the 100 solar mass. They can go up by 10,000 solar mass before the shell formation. And then I can really, I can also draw, plot this as a function of the super bubble radius. And now it's normalized with this H, but the H is not really the scale height, just a kind of proxy of the scale height, depending on the number density, background medium number density. So, it just give a sense that when this radius reach around one scale high or the two scale high of the background medium, they now really just break out from the galactic disk, not really going off from this, stay in this near uniform midplane region. So then we can just say, okay, that maybe this kind of mass will really blown out by the process of this super bubble breaks out. Then what we got for this hot gas mass per supernova is around 10 to 100 solar mass, which will give us this mass loading factor of 0.1 to 1. So this, what this says, when we really breaks out this super bubble after this shell formation time, then we always have this somehow low mass loading factor. We should have this low mass loading factor. Or this is all about the hot gas. And then, or if we can really break out those super bubbles before this shell formation, they can may reach mass loading factor, making give a mass loading factor around 10. But to make this kind of things happening, actually, we really need very, very short time interval, which can be translated into the mass of the star cluster, that we need real kind of super cluster, super star cluster. But that may be really the case of this starburst or galactic center, starburst center of the galaxies, starburst galaxies. but not really kind of usual case. And so also then what about this warm and cold medium that can maybe accelerate it? So if I just look at this somehow gas mass that has velocity higher than some given velocity, so this is a function of velocity. So that, let's say, to get about velocity higher than 200 kilometers per second, that is always stays in this tensorless mass range. But if we just look at this about this range around 50 to 100 kilometers per second, we can sometimes get this cumulative mass around 100, or sometimes we can get some 1,000, which means so this includes those warm medium that is accelerated by the supernova expansion. So if those galactic potential was shallower, so that the escape velocity is small, then maybe this gas can escape, which can give us some higher mass loading factor. So yeah, that is kind of thing we can learn from this simple toy model. Then what we want to really do is now learning this of some more realistic simulation to check whether this is okay or not. So
your star formation here is all like a single burst, right? A single cluster.
Yep.
I mean, and you're saying you're not getting quite enough oomph to get the stuff out. So if I go put the same cluster in a smaller galaxy, maybe it will work. I mean, likewise, what about putting, you might not have a bigger cluster in the same mass galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had some sort of interaction and the drove gas inflows in the center,
right.
I mean, what's the largest
burst
size you've considered here?
The star cluster is not really the meaning of the single star cluster with mm-hmm. that high mass. It's maybe the collection of effect within some scale.
Mm-hmm.
That scale maybe you can just think is the scale height of the galaxy. Mm-hmm. So for the galaxy center, that scale height is bit more, so let's say that we're doing 10 or 20 parsec. If we have a 10 to the 6, we have this 10 to the 6 solar mass or 10 to the 7 solar mass of new stars, then they may give some strong enough burst.
Right, this is the center of a galaxy. It could be 10 to the 9 solar
masses. Yeah, so that's...
But have you considered those scales? Or?
So that I want to really consider, but
yeah.
At this point, in our for our simulations, we don't really go that range.
That seems like another plausible solution.
Sure. Yeah,
to
that's the really one thing really want to do, I mean. And actually, yeah, that's also quite interesting because discussing in the morning, so because star formation, there is some time delay between star formation and this first supernova event. And that can be about a few million years to about 10 million years. And if we go to this kind of very galactic center region, then the dynamical time scale is much shorter. So that can be shorter than this time delay. Then we can keep collecting this possible supernova source during that time, and then burst at some point, then that will give a much stronger effect. So yeah, that will be some kind of beyond of our equilibrium picture, but that's a really possible solution. So we can really want to go there. Okay, so let me go to some realistic simulation that I include all these details of physics, self-gravity and single particle evolution, and some with some realistic, I shouldn't say this is a realistic, some model of this population synthesis of this 5 radiation and the supernova rate, and including the supernova feedback with high enough resolution that can measure all this evolution. And supernovae can also explode in the star cluster and run away that can represent collect this correlated supernovae and also specially distributed supernovae. And also using this local shearing box, we are learning it with galactic differential rotation that may be very important in prohibiting this large-scale gravitational collapse, and also it is very important for maintaining this mean field, magnetic field through this dynamo process. And we learned this long enough to erase initial conditions that may be very transient due to the initial some idealized initial condition. So I'm sure I will show you a time evolution of the density, temperature, pressure, and the vertical velocity, and the magnetic field strengths in radial vertical slice and the mid-plane slice. So I think this is the second time I'm playing this movie, so you may be more familiar with that. So we form the sink particle, this colored sink particles from this gravitational collapse. And then they will also shooting those runaways that are coming from some our chosen prescription. And I should make this loop. And then those star clusters host multiple supernovae, and each runaways can explode at some point with some single supernovae, and then they making this super bubble blown out, and the hot gas is going out, and the warm gas also somehow accelerated, but mainly stay there. So by this kind of process, I already showed that this star formation rate is well regulated with the changing of this thermal, the heating. But also we kind of lose all gas from the local box through the star formation by converting gas into the star, and also through this mass loss at the boundary. We really have this outflow, and then you can now first get an idea that this mass loss is not that high, as it's comparable to the star formation rate, or much actually it's smaller than the star formation rate.
So that's just the mass loading that you got in your idealized experiment?
Yeah, I will show that numbers later. So yeah, this is just kind of cumulative evolution. So yesterday I said I will explain this tomorrow. So this shows the temperature and the velocity plane with the mass-weighted probability density distribution. So most gas is in the warm medium state, and this warm medium has a temperature around 10 to the 4 Kelvin, and their velocity range from the range up to the 100 kilometers per second, but they cannot really go beyond that. And the cold medium stays in the about 10 kilometers per second range, and hot medium can only get reach the velocity around a few hundred kilometers per second. And this is just velocity magnitude. So if we just think about the one-dimensional velocity along the vertical direction that can really escape, it's just you should multiply one over square root of So the important thing is the kind of maximum velocity we get for this one medium is still around 100 kilometers per second. I just want to show this. We have this nice distribution of this cold from the temperature around 10 to the 1 Kelvin to the 10 Kelvin to the million and 10 million Kelvin. And it is nicely distributed within this variation of this mean variation of this heating rate, and there are lots of hot gas out there. And if we look at this outflow rate, I draw net outflow rate, which is defined by this outflow rate minus this inflow rate. So that this cool gas that showed the mean gas with temperature less than 10 to the 4 Kelvin, their rate is keep decreasing, which means they may eventually force back, not really going out. This is our box size. So, but the hot gas actually can really go out because they their net flux is actually conserving as function of vertical direction. And when we also look at this Bernoulli parameter, they are also constant as function of height after this 1 kiloparsec. And we also learning this bit with some bigger box and look at this whether this outflow rate can change or not. Then still the hot gas outflow rate is stay there, and the warm gas outflow rate is actually going down, keep going down, because now you can see there are lots of warm gas blobs out there, even at around 2 or 3 kiloparsec. But their velocity is sometimes it's actually merely already bluish. That means it's falling down. And some of them actually accelerated only a few tens of kilometers per second, while their hot gas has velocity higher than, larger than this, about a few hundred kilometers per second. They can really escape. So if I measure this mass loading factor at the boundary of our simulation domain, only for hot gas, then we get this outflow rate over star formation rate around 10% for all different gas substances. So we try to go to 100 solar mass per parsec square, and there are several technical difficulties to go there, especially we use this kind of some optically thin approximation for the heating, but that is not really true for this case. And their dynamical time is very short, but our some cluster evolution time is much longer, so that we want to cover at least a few cycles of this stellar evolution, but that actually requires lots of cycle of this dynamical cycle of this region, so it was quite difficult. But the bottom line is this hot gas only give us about mass loading factor around 0.1. That is really consistent with what this thing expects. And mainly also we use all the gravitational potential corresponding to this somehow Milky Way-like gravitational potential that has escape velocity around a few kilometers per second. So that means they cannot really escape. But we can still measure their outflow rate because we have this boundary at the box. But we can, if we measure outflow flux at 1 kiloparsec or 2 kiloparsec, they are decreasing. That means they will just falling back. It is true for other subsensitivity. And there is also trend of decreasing trend of the increasing subsensitivity, because our box size is actually effectively increasing by since they are really their scale height is much smaller. So what this says, but we can still say, okay, there are still lots of warm gas out there. They may contribute to the outflow if there is other mechanism that can accelerate maybe the cosmic ray feedback. Then if we add this to the outflow, then we can get some mass loading factor around 1, but that's kind of our expectation somehow. But that may or may not true. And if we go to the some shallower low mass halo or shallower potential, then they also can escape. Then that also can be can increase the mass loading factor. The thing I want to also make is this numerical convergence. So this is a simulation using 2 parsec resolution, and this is using the 64 parsec resolution. Definitely, they are very different from this one. I think this change somehow shows from this resolution and completely different here. So yeah, this kind of expected result, because the supernova feedback is not that efficient or not correct at low resolution. But we still kind of inject kind of final momentum when the supernova is not really resolved. So that actually gave us a correct star formation rate surface density up to 32 parsec, where we didn't really have, we have very different ISM structure. That means some hot gas volume filling factor within the scale height that is near the midplane, that there's no hot gas actually for this low resolution case. And also, if we measure the volume fraction of the warm gas at high vertical coordinate, then there's no warm gas out there with this low resolution simulations. So, yeah, it's kind of somehow.
Where do cosmological simulations land on this diagram?
I'm not really sure, but let's say the real large box simulation, their resolution should be a kiloparsec or about 100 parsec.
Sure, but like a zoom.
For the zoom, so, okay, zoom in simulations, they are trying, they are claiming their resolution is about sometimes a few parsec and sometimes 10 parsec. But, I mean, it's really hard to say whether that resolution is really the resolution we are really meaning. Sometimes, especially,
so
especially
adaptive.
For the particle-based code.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And the other issue maybe is, since usually they, for the grid-based simulation, they are using this AMR approach, that actually make the resolution very poor at this coronal region. Then, and then they also cannot really expect those cold gas out there. So yeah, I'm not really sure, but yeah, they. So some actually claims they are resolving this individual event, and they are resolving those interstellar medium structure where. So maybe we want to really compare those things. But the conclusion here is, at this point, the hot gas, mainly the supernovae driving real fast and hot galactic winds that only give us about mass rank factor order of 0.1. But this it is still possible that we can make heavily loaded hot wind with the star super bubble breaks out before the shell formation. And the warm medium is also accelerated up to this level, so that maybe we can, if they are escaping, they can contribute to the wind from the slow dwarf galaxies, or if they are further accelerated by this cosmic feedback. So it's quite an interesting thing. So I'm going to move on to synthetic observation, while although I don't have that much time, but do you guys have other questions about this part?
Well, yeah, I'm curious. I mean, for your supernova-driven wind, I mean, like for the old like Chevalier and Clegg 85 solutions. I mean, so you can write down an analytic solution in the idealized case. I'm curious, right, when you actually do a simulation with a real two-phase ISM and you put in your supernovae one by one and stuff. I mean, how different is your result from the analytic solution? What new insight do you gain?
I mean, I would say that Chevalier and Clegg model, they need a mass loading factor as a parameter, right?
Well, it depends. Yeah, I mean, they parameterize that. They parameterize the. There's a variance of that, right? That Boqi Wong did with radiative cooling in the wind.
Okay.
But it'd be interesting to know, like, how what you find with the numerics compared to the analytics.
Yeah, I mean, the in our case, this is kind of mass loading factor we can get from this supernovae explosion, supernova-driven wind in the state of the hot. But yeah, I mean, there is a so yeah, I assume that those model with the cooling that can they saying that the multiphase wind can be a result of this cooling from the hot wind. that way, assuming this heavily loaded hot wind, I assume, so that they are somehow trying to argue that is really blowing out from the center of the galaxy. And yeah, at this point, I cannot really tell that this is really possible because I didn't really have a model for this kind of thing. And so that's the thing I really want to look at right now. Yeah. And for the simple models, I mean, the difference in our case, it's kind of we are only can give somehow information of the foot point of the wind. They will further accelerated by this adiabatic expansion stage. But that is not included here. So, but I mean, those kind of acceleration is only possible for this volume filling hot gas, not for this warm gas things. So if there are this amount of mass that is available, but they are in this 1 million phase, then I think they will not really accelerate by this process. Those acceleration is only for this hot gas. Then for high heavy loaded wind, we still need heavy loaded hot wind, not this multiphase wind in the first place. Then those multiphase wind can only be accelerated by some other process in our simulation if they are not really escaped from the this shallow potential. So yeah, that's the other thing we want to really go, like this co-simulated feedback. So okay, so I will talk a little bit about the synthetic observation. This is quite important to build the synthetic observation because most physical properties in the simulations are not directly observable, so it is very useful to construct these synthetic observations, basically for this apple-to-apple comparison, or sometimes the observational the physical properties driven by from the derived by observation, they assume some. They made some simple assumption to get the to make this. Observational diagnostics. So we may really want to test whether this can give a real physical properties from this realistic observation, or realistic simulations. So I did this for my previous simulations for two-phase medium, self-regulated by the supernova feedback, but not that realistic. But I did somehow radiative transfer for given ray. Along that way and do these things for entire skies. So the way to develop this is just first get this line of sight data from the density, temperature, velocity. I construct the H1 21 centimeter lines in this case. So using this density, temperature, and velocity, I kind of calculate this emissivity and the absorption coefficient with including some different excitation mechanism. But it's actually quite, I then realized that that is not that simple, even though it is just a simple two-level population lines, but there are some other excitation mechanism I should include, but it's not really well known, so-called Riemann-Alpha scattering. Resonance scattering. I cannot really pronounce it that his name, but maybe his name.
So Paul Weizen.
We so called this a WF effect. Voltaizen.
Phase
effect. So yeah, but we don't really know this Riemann alpha radiation photon density. So I should assume some value, but it is not important for the cold medium, but it is important for the warm medium. But then I can construct these lines by using some shape function. So this is some example. If I extract this line of sight information for density and the temperature and the velocity, I can calculate the spin temperature. Here you can see as red line, red dotted line for without this WF effect, and this blue dashed line with this WF effect with very simple prescription by assuming some constant Riemann alpha photon density. They only affect very low optical depth region where the 1 medium is dominant. So 1 medium is the So this is kind of some old sky map that I only show this for the purpose of to maybe you can think this is quite looks okay. So I want to if you feel like that. So but I did some detailed comparison between plotting all this brightness temperature and optical depth distribution, and there are several absorption and emission observation that I can really compare. Then I would say that distribution was quite okay. So it can reproduce those kind of typical interstellar medium, typical neutral interstellar medium quite well. So now what can we do?
Why is a neutral interstellar medium the first place to start for probing galactic winds? I'm just trying to understand.
No, it's not for the galactic wind, sorry. So this is I just go back to the some basics of the synthetic observations, and I will go to the galactic winds later, but I'm not really at that stage. So this is the kind of thing I did before for this neutral interstellar medium, but I think I can do similar thing for my new simulations to get some idea about this galactic wind.
What feature of your simulations are you testing here?
Yeah, so I mean, this is actually so I can construct this lines from that them, and that lines are quite in some sense it's quite realistic, especially for this neutral medium. Then I can really compare their column density estimator using those lines, which is usually you can get this column density by this kind of equation by integrating this absorption and emission lines, then compare this with real line of sight integrated column density that I have. So then I can see, is this okay? Yeah, I should say this is okay.
This verifies that your simulation produces the right amount of cold neutral medium.
Not really. That's not the proof of our simulation. It's the proof of the observational diagnostic.
Okay.
So I mean, I want to compare. I want to do this because I want to say, okay, their observed properties are really okay. Then I can really directly compare our measurement with the observation directly. Then whether they agree with each other, then I can say, okay, my simulation reproduces it well. But if they are not, then okay, my simulation may miss something. So that's the kind of purpose of this study. So for this study, I just check this kind of diagnostics. We can get this line of sight integrated column density quite well using both absorption and emission line, but when you don't have this absorption line information, you will underestimate column density quite a lot for high optical depths, definitely. So that's what. But sometimes people only use this optically thin approximation, optically thin estimator for column density. And then they want to correct it with some correction factor based on this optical test. That we can give some idea for that. But actually, there was another paper that said they did this kind of thing, but they have much larger correction factor because they don't really do this numerical simulation. They are just placing all the different warm and cold medium along this line of sight by hand, and then that actually increases a lot for this velocity overwrapping because they don't really have this dynamics information. So that actually this says that maybe only you can actually still get quite okay value at some point. And then the skin temperature also can be well estimated. And similarly, using this spin temperature, line of sight integrated spin temperature information, what this shows is you can get this cold medium fraction quite very well if you assume some single temperature of the cold medium. And then after that, other group actually really look at this absorption and emission pair for this Perseus cloud, and then they measure this cold medium mass fraction with this kind of method. But they should assume the cold medium temperature around 50. But this anyway, this will give the cold medium fraction range quite okay. And there is they also use some other method, so-called they use the Gaussian decomposition method to get this cold medium fraction, and then actually matches agrees with quite okay, except these two cases, two line of sights. So okay, that's maybe okay, and we can really infer this line of sight integrated column density and the line of sight averaged spin temperature, and as well as cold medium fraction through this emission absorption observations. And then we also did some more sophisticated model that are used from this group. So they are developing some autonomous Gaussian decomposition method with some machine learning algorithm, very fancy machine learning algorithm. That what they did is they kind of decompose all this brightness temperature profile and the emission profile and absorption profile with different component. And then what we can really do now is, because this synthetic observation is really coming from this one, so we can really compare whether this kind of picture really corresponding to some real feature in the intercept medium or the H1 gas along that line of sight. And yeah, that's not really good for if the number of components is increasing. It's only good up to number of structure 2 or 3. If the number is larger than that, that means you will really overwrap in the velocity space, then you will screw up your profile quite easily. So it is a reliable method for high galactic latitude, but not that small, low galactic latitude. And then for each component, we can also calculate the spin temperature and the column density for that only component and compare it with some real value. Then that's, I mean, those estimation is still wide, very, has a large scatter for the low latitude, but where the component is really overlaps, but it's okay for high latitude. So their method can give some information for that. Then we can really compare our simulation, and then now we can really say, oh, their distribution didn't have this bump here, and their distribution has much more component here. Then maybe come from because we use very simple approximation for this WF effect that actually gives somehow constant spin temperature all the case. Or the we don't have this kind of gas where maybe this kind may indicating the fast moving one medium that we don't really have in this model because we don't have that component, especially for this fountain flows. But we may have them in our new simulation. So it's very interesting to reanalyze, reapplying this method to our new simulation and compare this with this broad observation. Okay, so and then I want to go quickly. What I can really do with this Tigris? So this now the Tigris simulation is MHD simulation. Now I can really construct this dust polarization map. And then I want to compare this with the Planck polarization map that actually show E and B mode, E mode and B mode polarization power ratio about 2. That is an issue, some interesting question they raised from this Planck observation, and I want to see whether we can really reproduce this from our simulation. And then we can also do some molecular chemistry things and then test whether whether this so-called local approximations to calculate the shielding length can reproduce a real full ray tracing using the chemistry using the full ray tracing. So that was done before, and we also going pushing this forward to running some zoom-in simulation of the molecular clouds that they just extract some part of our cloud and they running it with AMR that can, whether we can really see that. And also we also want to analyzing, once include those chemistry thing with our dynamical model by using some simplified but accurate enough chemical networks. So this is also work is going on, and then that actually give some information about this XCO factor variation. That is one very big question. And then finally, I can add some ray tracing algorithm that can really follow their evolution, the propagation of this far UV radiation or the ionizing radiation. They can that I can really see the real special variation of this radiation, and also I can learn some escaping fraction kind of information from this simulation. Okay, so yeah, there are lots of things to do, and I will stop here. Yeah.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, Crystal.
Well, so I mean, there's lots of things you'd like to do with a great code like this. what is the thing where you think you're, I mean, what is the question where you think you're really going to have the biggest impact here when you kind of weigh what you'd like to answer versus reality of what you can do?
Well, yeah.
What's your number one question you're going to go after?
So, I mean, right now, this kind of chemistry and the ray tracing thing is already there. So, I mean, it's just a matter of time of learning it. So, it's very straightforward, but it is very, it has also quite a large impact on this, our understanding on this CO and the H2 conversion, and also this non-equilibrium chemistry kind of thing. So, this is a one big question, and also when I include those ray tracing in there, we now can have ionizing radiation effect that can give additional feedback as well as this information of the escaping fraction. That actually very important because all those escaping fraction information is usually coming from this cosmological simulation where they don't really have this fine structure, and then from this very multi-phase structure at especially at high Z with this ray tracing, we can really see whether this escaping fraction can really increase and decrease as function of this time and as function of the other conditions. So, I mean, those things are also very important question, and I can really step forward to do that. So, I would say that it was first priority right now, but the other thing is, since our simulation is mainly the local simulation, so I want to really go to the global simulation where I can really model the entire galaxy. But I cannot really still model with these cosmological flows, but this somehow large scale structure and also with this global effect of this gas evolution, I think that is very important, and that's the one thing I want to push forward right now. Yeah. Oh, I shouldn't miss that the cosmic ray feedback thing, but I would say that has lots of uncertainty. So I need lots of help from the experts for that field. So yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, we've been keeping him from lunch all day, so I think so Evan, if you could just go down, that would be fantastic. And let's thank John Gu again.